Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up for Monday, June 8th, 2026. Thanks for joining us here on this Monday morning. We got a good show for you lined up today. We're going to start off talking about unionization efforts at the Amazon facility at YVR. As you may know, well, Amazon is one of the largest employers around these days, with facilities all across the country and all across the world, really, and multiple facilities have also fought tooth and nail against any unionization efforts at any of their workplaces, going so far as to entirely shut down and contract out operations in Quebec a few years ago after a successful unionization effort there. We're going to be talking to representative from the Western Regional District of Unifor about how negotiations are going, and a report from the mediator that was released last week. We also have a report about problems facing salmon in the Fraser River. It's described as a bit of a toxic soup for salmon, and that has a lot of implications for the health of the river and the health of the salmon run, and even all the way out to the health of orcas, which are reliant on salmon for their food source. Gardening with Embark is here a little later in the program. And we're going to be talking about how gardening leads to many other activities. And finally, Peter R. H. will be here towards the end of the show with his commentary for the week. So our interview with Grant McGarrigal, as the Western Regional Director of Unifor, and they're the union representing workers at the YVR2 facility at Amazon. It's a really interesting interview. First, we're going to start out talking about how the unionization drive got to the point that it is, which was not an easy journey against Amazon. We're also going to talk then about the current state of the negotiations, where the mediator appointed by the BC Labour Relations Board has declared that Amazon is responsible for an impasse due to their sort of negotiating tactics that are really meant to stymie any forward progress. And we're going to finish off talking a bit about where things go from here, both with the specific negotiation, but also dealing with large employers like this, like Amazon, Starbucks, and others, who are really vehemently opposed to unions in their shops. Anyway, this is our interview, and please enjoy.
Joining me now is Gavin McGarrigal, Western Regional Director for Unifor. Last week, a mediator for the BC Labour Relations Board issued a report critical of Amazon and blaming them for the impasse in negotiations for the first contract between the company and its workers at the Vancouver Airport Distribution Centre. Before we get into the details of that, can you tell me a bit, because this is the first contract between the workers and Amazon, and can you tell me a bit about how the unionization drive and certification came about there?
Sure. It's quite a story, but at the end of the day, we're looking at, in the next few weeks, seeing the first collective agreement for Amazon workers in North America, right here in British Columbia. After years of effort, we've been joined by Amazon workers reaching out to us all across the country, and here in British Columbia in 2024, we started to have organizers out front and signing cards, talking to workers about their issues. Finding out that health and safety and the pace of work was a real issue. The way that people get permanent jobs there or not is a big issue. And there's really lots of normal workplace issues that you see in any warehouse. And somehow Amazon had put out this idea that they're unorganizable and untouchable, but they're operating in Canada. They're operating under our labor laws. British Columbia has strong labor laws. They can always be stronger, but in this case, they worked. We applied for two warehouses for certification, one of about 700, 800 members at YVR2, which is a large fulfillment center in Delta, BC. And the other one was in New Westminster. And right away, we saw Amazon's tactics. We saw padding of employee lists. We saw a very pervasive anti-union campaign all throughout the workforce. And we withdrew those applications and ended up applying for YVR2. And again, the same pattern persisted. And after 18 days of hearings in, I believe it was 2024, it's been a few years now, the BC Labor Relations Board found that indeed Amazon did break the BC Labor Relations Code. They did commit unfair labor practices. They bombarded employees with anti-union pervasive messaging, well in excess of anything permitted by the code. And they also, most importantly, were found to have padded employee hiring lists to deny the union an ability to reach the threshold to get either an automatic certification at 55% or a vote at 45% plus. So the combination of all these things made the employees' wishes very hard to tell. And so the Labor Board reached for the remedy that it has, which is an automatic certification. So the union became certified at YVR2, and we've been in bargaining for the last number of months. The certification decision was so important, though, that following that, the Labor Board actually ordered the union to have the ability in Amazon's lunchrooms to meet with Amazon workers on paid time by Amazon. And so I was there with those meetings with our Unifor team. We had about 8 or 10 meetings. We had hundreds of Amazon employees in every single meeting talking to us about things that workers normally talk about, which is, you know, how do they have some stability? How do they have a safe workplace? How do they get paid decently and fairly for what they do? And so we went into those, but at the exact same time that was going on, you had Amazon making decisions on wages. And while I was in those meetings, some employees were upset because Amazon had decided right at that exact time to give wage increases to all of the other Amazon warehouses in the Lower Mainland, including free Prime membership, but not to our members at the YVR2.
Was that something you think was intended to try and send a message?
Yes, absolutely. And it was intended to send a message that somehow you get punished for being unionized instead of being protected. And we knew that that's not what the law said. We vowed right then and there in that lunchroom that we would not stop fighting until we got every penny that those workers were owed, that they could put their faith in the union and the system. And they did. We continued bargaining in the meantime. We elected a bargaining committee. We surveyed the membership. We're working on sitting down with the company, but we continued our labor relations claim. And then earlier this year, the Labor Board came out and agreed with us. And they said that Amazon had a procedure for asking to vary any conditions, and they didn't follow that they withheld the wages and for all of these employees. And the Labor Board ordered every single penny to be paid back to all of those workers. We estimate that that's over $1 million in back pay, about 6 months of back pay, anywhere from $1.50 to $3 an hour, and everyone's wages to be adjusted upwards after that. And that's exactly what happened. We're still in hearings at the Labor Board about additional damages on that to the union and to the workers for Amazon's behavior. At this point, we just have a bottom line decision that says, that was an incorrect decision by Amazon. They had to pay everyone. And so now we're into the final stages of bargaining. Clearly, we haven't been able to get progress while all this is going on.
All this you've been telling me about isn't even the thing we're here to talk about today. This is all just part of the difficult process you've been through so far.
That's right. And we're throwing our full weight behind this. We're used to dealing with the biggest corporations on the planet, whether it's in the auto sector or aerospace or rail or anywhere else. And Amazon ultimately is no different. We have the resources and the expertise to be able to do it. And the workers want a union. Yeah. So they're just going to have to deal with that. And we've now applied for mediation under Section 55 of the Labor Code. We've had that mediation. The mediator has delivered his report. And essentially, he said that, once again, Amazon is the one that's being the holdup here. They refuse to table wage proposals throughout bargaining. until very, very late in bargaining. They were asked repeatedly by the mediator to do that, and they didn't. They took unreasonable positions, basically trying to get the union to agree that we couldn't challenge any of their productivity or health and safety standards or anything of that nature, telling us that they wanted to apply standards from all the other warehouses to the collective agreement, but at the same time, they couldn't apply the same wage increases to everyone in the same warehouses. So really just obstruction and trying to block a collective agreement. The labor, the mediator's report has recommended to the labor board that this be resolved by binding mediation. And so that means that no matter what Amazon does here, they're going to be facing a collective agreement at YVR2 as soon as we hear back from the labor board, which is usually just a ratification of the mediator's suggestion. And then we expect to be finalizing the terms of what it looked like. We'll give it our best shot, of course, in mediation, but ultimately the mediator would be empowered to impose the first collective agreement at Amazon in North America.
So was there a period of direct negotiations between the union and the company, or did
Yes.
you have to go straight into mediation?
No, we met for weeks on end. Yeah. We've been meeting all year, late last year as well. We have a large bargaining committee. We're sitting down with the employers, with their lawyers. We're doing negotiations. We're doing all the things that you're supposed to be doing. But unfortunately, we have someone on the other side in terms of Amazon that clearly doesn't want to have a collective agreement, somehow thinks that their behavior is not in violation of the law when their decisions are piling up against Amazon. And we still have more unfair labor practice complaints against them. As I said, the damages on this issue, and also they're leading a decertification campaign, we believe, and we've filed charges at the board on that. Intimidation, you know, there's a full list of things that the board is still dealing with. But we're keeping moving forward. We're positive. The members are strong. And like I said, they just can't wait to get that collective agreement so that we can start some real enforcement and some real accountability for Amazon's behavior.
So one of the issues they were cited for, as you mentioned, was, you know, a refusal to consider any discussion around worker productivity and work, you know, how much work people are expected to do and working conditions. That seems a fairly fundamental part of any sort of collective agreement, that there should be some guidelines around that.
Yeah, exactly. And the mediator saw through that. I mean, there's a distinction between hard bargaining and just completely untenable bargaining. And they were doing untenable bargaining where you simply can't make any progress. And, you know, he also exposed the, you know, I would call it the double standard of their position. On the one hand, they were saying they couldn't possibly agree to any changes to any of their policies or procedures because it had to apply everywhere. And therefore, they wanted us to sign off on that. But in the same breath, they said, but they also couldn't agree to give the wages and benefits and all of the other things that they were giving to the other warehouses. So they're speaking out of both sides of their mouths. We saw through it, of course, at the table. The mediator saw through it. And so Amazon's not ultimately going to get what they want on that. And they're going to have to have whatever compromise the mediator determines is appropriate.
So the next step now will be, based on this report, which, you know, gets turned into an order from the labor board. So that will move it to the next step, and it'll be arbitrated. So that'll just move the process through at that point. How does that work?
Yeah, so there's options under the labor code under Section 55. One of the options is strike or lockout. And then another option is binding mediation, and another option is arbitration. And, you know, a mediator has to go through and make a report to the associate chair on which of those options. Amazon wanted to pursue strike or lockout. The union wanted binding arbitration and mediation as a secondary, a binding mediation secondary. The mediators considered all of those, given a report to the associate chair that says, for all the reasons cited in his report, he thinks binding mediation is the way to go. So once the associate chair rules on that and agrees with that, which is usually the case, then the mediator, whether it's that mediator or another one, I imagine it would be the same one, would basically have the power to impose his recommendations as the new collective agreement. So it wouldn't be like a formal arbitration. It would be continued mediation. At the end of the day, the mediator deciding, having the final say on anything that's outstanding.
Amazon has a history of really fighting very, very aggressively, and you've seen that here against unionization, even to the point of closing down operations that have successfully unionized. I think that happened in Quebec a few years ago, where they shut down the whole provincial distribution operation and contracted it out. Is that a concern here?
Well, we certainly knew that Amazon was anti-union, but essentially we've been dealing with that every day across the country. And, you know, they try to make it seem like because they're, you know, some kind of technology company that they're different. But, you know, we represent DHL Courier, we represent Air Canada, we represent warehouses all across the country. We know supply chains, and those things are things that can be and are successfully addressed every day. And there are, you know, hundreds of thousands of workers who go to work every single day under those conditions. So we knew we were in for a fight from Amazon. We saw what they did in Quebec. There's still pending litigation from what they've done in Quebec. Huge public outcry in Quebec and indeed across the country. We brought in the premier and the labor minister came in and met several months ago with the Amazon workers to talk to them about their struggles in organizing, about what they hope to see in the first collective agreement. We've been very clear that we are not going to go away on this, not just here in BC, but across the country. We'll throw the full weight of our union behind this. And this is a bigger certification than in Quebec. In Quebec, it was a much smaller facility. This is a major fulfillment center right in the center of everything. And, you know, number one, I don't think Amazon would legally get away. Politically, I don't think they would get away with it. And then in terms of consumer confidence, you would now have a massive corporation thumbing its nose and not one but two provinces and then expecting to do business. So I don't think that's in the cards for Amazon. I think the best thing is what we've been saying all along, which is put some good faith into this. Let's sit down and let's try and get this agreement in place and then move forward on dealing with the workers' issues so everyone can go back to business and just doing what we do.
Do you think the sort of current labor laws are working well for dealing with companies like this? And what I mean is, you know, a company like Amazon or Starbucks, where rather than a sort of handful of large workplaces like an automaker might have, you know, there are, you know, dozens and dozens of much smaller facilities. And it seems like a very difficult process to sort of deal with them one at a time. Also, when, you know, the company does have the option of closing down a workplace, Starbucks has done that with shops that have successfully unionized. Does there need to be some change in the rules around this to balance that out?
Well, so far, the Labor Board's done what it's supposed to do, and this is issue decisions. We always want the decisions to be issued faster. We're appealing a one Labor Board decision on a procedural matter. So that process is working. And as I said, we're moving forward toward the first collective agreement. But more broadly speaking, yes, you're absolutely right. The Labor Code needs significant changes and modifications. It needs to be updated for the 21st century. One glaring example that I'll give is gig workers. You know, everyone says the labor code across the country is built on a union demonstrating a certain percentage membership, whether it's 45% for a vote or 55% for an automatic certification. And, you know, places like a factory or a workplace, you know, the workers might be able to figure that out. But in terms of gig workers, they will never know what that 100% number is. I was talking to Uber drivers who work out of YVR Airport, and they don't know if there's 400 of them or 8,000 of them. And there's simply no way to do it. So I think politicians are being very disingenuous when they look at us and say, follow the labor code. And yet there are entire sections of the population that really have no access to it, not because of anything they want to do, but because the rules are so antiquated. Sectoral bargaining and broad-based bargaining are other issues that we've been calling for years. This government is actually sitting on a labor relations review code report that came out really just before the election, and we haven't heard much action on that. It was a terrible report, frankly, and most of the unions were scathing in their denunciation of it. So yeah, there needs to be a lot more effort, not just here but across the country, into updating and modernizing labor standards across the country to make it more easy to organize both these different types of employers, or so they like to style themselves, and the small employers. And there needs to be much more ability to, you know, tie certifications to broad-based areas instead of the shop-by-shop model. That shop-by-shop model has its benefits as well, but there needs to be a thorough updating on that. Currently, we're in the middle of a federal labor code review by the federal government, which we don't think is being undertaken in good faith. It's I think it's a 90-day process, a really tight time frame. So no government is dealing with the labor code change that need to be made, and they're urgent right now because these workers need a collective agreement, and they need some representation, and they need some decent standards so that we can boost the economy for everybody.
When do you expect a decision from the Labor Board in response to this report?
I expect that in the next few weeks. Sooner is always better, but we don't expect them to be taking a lot of time on this. And, you know, as I said, the only real question mark is in my mind is it going to be the same mediator or different mediator? And then what's the time frame for that? And certainly the mediator knows the urgency that we've conveyed in terms of getting these workers some protection. So we hope to have this wrapped up before the end of the summer.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for talking to me today. Gavin McGarrigle is the Western Regional Director for Unifor, which is the union representing the workers at YVR in their negotiations with Amazon. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And thanks again to Gavin McGarrigle. He's the Western Regional Director for Unifor. They expect to have the Labor Board issue its decision based on the mediator's report in the next couple of weeks, and then things will move on to an arbitrated settlement. We did reach out to Amazon for a comment or interview, and they did not get back to us by our deadline. So we'll continue to follow this story. Thanks for tuning into CJSF today. You're listening to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. Quick look at the weather. And it's going to be a pretty nice week this week. Today, of course, the forecast is periods of rain beginning this afternoon with a high to 17. More rain overnight with a low down to 12. Tomorrow is going to be a sort of mix of sun and rain. Chance of showers 70% with a high up to 18. From there, things start getting a little better. More mix of sun and cloud on Wednesday. And then Thursday, and then the rest of the week, it looks like clear and sunny skies with highs up to 22 by Friday and 26 and 28 on Sunday. So it's going to be a really nice weekend to head to the beach or the lake or get yourself outdoors to enjoy things.
This is Bird Note. In shallow waters off the coast of Massachusetts, ocean predators come from far and wide to hunt. Humpback whales break the surface as they close their jaws around a school of fish. And thousands of seabirds dive in the water or skim the surface for easy prey. Great shearwaters glide with their wings held out stiffly just over the waves until they spot their shimmering targets. These top predators are all here thanks to tiny fish called sand lance. They bury themselves in the sand at night for protection, emerging during the day to feed in huge numbers. That's when shearwaters dive for them and humpback whales gulp them down. But sand lance are vulnerable to climate change. They have their offspring in the winter, so rising temperatures could make it harder for their young to develop successfully. That puts the rest of the ecosystem, including seabirds, at risk. Biologists are exploring the link between shearwaters and their tiny prey by tracking the birds' movements around Stellwagen Bank National Marine Sanctuary. Learn more on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Ariana Rimmel. This episode is dedicated to Bob Goodale, whose lifelong love for birds and nature continues to inspire.
Reporting from Burnaby, BC, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. A recent research study out of Simon Fraser University has found over 200 contaminants in the lower Fraser River, as well as fish tissue collected in the same area. These contaminants pose potential major risks for the river's juvenile Chinook salmon populations, as well as other aquatic life. Some of the contaminants in the study include antidepressants, blood pressure medications, caffeine, and even cocaine. A shocking discovery, but it's hard to know the severity of these findings without more context from the researchers involved. To learn more about the study, what these findings mean for Chinook salmon, and what can be done to address this issue, CJSF reached out to the senior author of the study, Tanya Brown, for a conversation. Tanya Brown is an ecotoxicologist and assistant professor of marine ecotoxicology at SFU. The first question we asked her was, as an ecotoxicologist, Were these findings shocking to you?
Knowing the body of research and other bodies of work that have been done elsewhere, I wouldn't say it was shocking to me. It is sort of what I would have expected to find. But what's shocking to me, I guess the shocking part, is that we are finding these chemicals in our waterways, right? And this is what we're exposing, you know, important prey, not only for our marine mammal species, but also for humans. And so what we're exposing what we're consuming, you know, we are consuming Chinook salmon as well as many other salmonid species. So just thinking about it in that context as well. Yes, we were looking at juvenile Chinook. So what you would measure, say, in a juvenile Chinook relative to an adult Chinook could look very different. But it's not just looking from it from that lens. We're looking at it, what is the quality, how are we setting up these young Chinook salmon for entering their kind of their adult, their marine rearing life stage that they go out to sea for, you know, 4 years and then return back to spawn in their natal stream. So are we even setting them up for success to even make it through their first year out at sea, right? So I'm looking at it from that lens. And then I'm looking at it from the lens of being like, wow, you know, okay, maybe I'm not overly surprised with what we detected, but it's very alarming in and of itself, right? And to just think about, you know, they're basically swimming in a cocktail of chemicals continuously while they're out migrating, and this is all being discharged and into our oceans, right? So I think thinking about it from that lens, then it's, you know, that's sort of the concerning and shocking side of things.
And like you had mentioned, it has like a ripple effect because these salmon are also the main prey for other species as well. And that's going to have an effect just on like the larger ecosystem as a whole.
Exactly. Exactly. And so, and this is just, you know, contaminants is just one of many stressors that Chinook and other Pacific salmon populations are having to navigate and deal with. Right. And so it's just thinking about it from that lens and perspective, just the cumulative risks that the cumulative threats that are imposed on them at such a young life stage is concerning.
Mm-hmm. How do things such as like antidepressants or caffeine or any of these sort of contaminants like end up in the waterways?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, there's so many. If you look, I don't know anybody who's flown into YVR into Vancouver, but you always fly in, you're looking over the Fraser River. So there's just in the lower Fraser River, it's, you know, lots of industry, obviously heavily urbanized area. So stormwater runoff, every time it rains, there's a volume of chemicals that are, you know, with that rainwater is also carrying a number of contaminants, whether it's hydrocarbons from our streets, tire associated chemicals, pesticides from agricultural runoff, all of this would be coming into the Fraser River. And then also into our lower flowing tributaries that also flow into the Fraser River, where they would be expected to be at even higher concentrations. And these are also really important salmon rearing areas. So I think, you know, it's industry. So those are our point sources, non-point sources, when we're thinking about the agricultural runoff that I mentioned, wastewater treatment effluent, number of wastewater treatment plants all along the lower Fraser. So there's just a number of sources coming in.
Now, I know this was a bit past the scope of the study, but looking at the data that was collected, one of the main thoughts that came into my head is what can even be done about this? Mm-hmm. What should be done about this? And I'm wondering if you have any perspective on that to share.
Yeah, I think my hope, you know, going into this study was to, one is to bring about awareness, you know, for the general public, but for the scientific community of like, you know, and it's, you know, what we painted, you know, detecting over 200 chemicals, there are far more chemicals in that system than what we detected. That's just, we went out and we tried to measure as many possible chemicals as possible but if you look at, in Canada, we have over 3,200 high volume use chemicals that are used in production in this country. And so we just don't have the capacity or the analytical capacity to measure those. So this, you know, it's this 200 is there's much more that these salmon are being exposed to. And so when I'm thinking about that, one thing is just one to draw awareness, you know, in terms of what are we detecting out there, but the context of what we put it in this research that we did was it's one thing to detect a chemical or pollutant, but it's another to relate that to risk. So we were looking at it in terms of the toxicity.